Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Welcome in. Time for KER Politics. I'm going to start out the show here, our first two segments, with a very interesting man who's been on the radio show before. He is a well-known author, PhD. His name is Dr. Gleb Tsiversky. Dr. Tsiversky has written a book. It's called Never Go With Your Gut. An expert tells you something along the lines of why not. It's available at Amazon and other booksellers. Let's start out, Gleb, if you don't mind. Talk about your book.
Sure. And thank you again for having me on, Al. It's a pleasure. The book talks about how we have a tendency to think that essentially we think with our gut instead of our brain. And that's how we make our decisions, whether in politics, whether in business, whether in personal matters. And the book talks about, specifically focuses on business, how do we make sure that we don't screw up our careers and our finances and our business decisions by using this tendency to go with our gut, and instead make the right decisions, make the wise decisions that will be the most profitable and the most effective for reaching whatever our goals are. And again, like I said, it's applicable to politics, to life areas, relationships, anything.
You know, I have to say one thing, and then Jimmy, if you could come in, talking a little bit about, as our listeners are aware, Jim and I talk almost 7 days a week between editorials and syndicated radio about the political situation in the United States right now. Unfortunately, when I started to take a look at your book, Gleb, I had the distinct impression that what you were saying is in all important decisions, be they business, being they social, being they political, what have you, you simply can't go with your heart. I use the word heart. You use the word go. When you say gut, I believe you're referring to emotions. You can't go with emotions because you stand a very good chance of coming up with an incorrect, capitalize that bold letters, an incorrect decision. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, I would say you tend to come up with a disastrous decision. Your emotions are valuable for actually figuring out your values. What do you value? What do you think is important? And we all have different things that we think are important, that we feel are important. And that's the right place for emotions. Emotions are a terrible place to make decisions because the way to achieve your values, that's the rational way. You need to think with your mind, not with your brain, not with your heart, not with your gut, when you're figuring out how to achieve your values. Because there are better paths and worse paths to achieving your values, to achieving whatever you want to achieve. And only by analyzing with your mind what's the best path can you get there. Why is that? Well, our gut intuitions are adapted for the savanna environment. You know, in the savanna environment, the politician in charge was the tribal chief with the big stick, you know, of in charge of 50 people. And we still, our gut still appeals to this tribal chief with a big stick and the 50 people, the alpha male, who is the prototypical political leader. That is what our hearts are pulled to, our guts are pulled to. And those are the people, if we allow ourselves to go with our gut, that's where the majority of the population will turn to if we don't use our head, if we don't use our minds to make the right decisions about where we want our politics to be. And the same thing in business, how we want our business to be, our businesses will tend to turn to the big political chief, the big business CEO chief, as opposed to the best decision to achieve our goal.
Gleb, what can you identify some of the key emotional mistakes that some, you know, senior business leaders have made, or just some of the I guess, how can we shape this into give some specifics of mistakes that have been made in the past?
Sure.
that you can identify.
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest mistakes right now that we're seeing coming out is with Boeing. So the Boeing leadership made a decision that because of their past history of having very safe and secure planes, these new 737 MAX would be safe and secure despite what we now know their engineers were saying. They were saying, hey, this system, the one that caused the crashes, is not safe and secure. We need to really redo things. We need to slow things down. We need to not produce the 737 until it's fixed. And the leadership was saying, no, we need to go, and right now we need to compete with our competitors, and so we need to produce the 737 immediately, very quickly. And so they rushed. And why is that? Because of the past history of everything feeling safe. And that's called the normalcy bias. This is one of over 100 cognitive biases, and this book is the first book to focus on cognitive biases and business leadership and how we can address these biases. There are over 100 cognitive biases, and one of them is the normalcy bias, where we tend to not think about things that don't occur, disasters that don't occur often. And of course, Boeing's disaster with the 737 did not occur in the past. So the leadership made a terrible mistake by rushing and getting, right now Boeing is pretty screwed. It's, I think, at the last that I saw, it lost about $2 billion. $2 billion, hard to imagine number, as a result of the 737 MAX crisis, and don't lose even more.
It's interesting. It reminds me a bit of, and I'm wondering how much institutional bias, because of you have these very large corporations that begin to have momentum on their own, very similar to governments, in fact, and then decisions are made, and you don't hear little pieces of it, and sometimes we just assume. Many people just assume that the system will work it out. And it just reminds me of the Challenger disaster and Morton Thiokol and the rockets and the engineers talking about the O-rings, the same type of a problem Boeing has here, this institutional bias of, hey, well, someone else has responsibility for it and they'll work it out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this is a good, and that's a great insight, this institutional bias, this assumption from the leadership in this case, the great deal of confidence, too much confidence, that they have in the history of Boeing safety. And that's something that caused them a great deal of trouble right now. We can take a look at another big institution, GE, General Electric. Now, that has a great history of having very wise financial decision-making in how it structured its debt and its finances. And as we have recently learned, they have really screwed up their accounting under the last couple of CEOs, in such a way that GE may go bankrupt. Realistically speaking, it may well go bankrupt because it felt too secure, too confident, and they were kicking the can down the road. So that's another example of institutional bias that's really screwing up the situation for GE right now.
You know, I want to say one thing, and that is the best marketing that a person can do is to market by example. I talked about that a little bit this morning in a Bible study that I was in. But what I want to talk about in the next segment, because in about 2 minutes here, about a minute here actually, we're going to have to take a commercial break. But I think that if you could list as many, many examples as you possibly can that have happened in the business world. Now, what I'm curious about, Gleb, is have any disasters really occurred, for example, in the world of IT? Something else I'd like you to talk about right after the break here is I want you to talk about the concept, the psychological concept of cognitive biases, because my gut mm-hmm. tells me the cognitive biases have an awful lot to do with why this problem even exists. I want to say one thing, folks, mm-hmm. in wrapping up this particular segment is that Gleb is no newcomer to this business. He's had 20 years of experience in doing this type of work, bringing psychology into decision-making, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to tell you, when you look at his credentials, some of the very well-known business leaders in our country that have endorsed him, you will be amazed. We'll tell you at the end of the next segment how you can specifically get hold of the book. Stick around. I'm going to be right back with Gleb Tsivarsky.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Back with Lev Tvarsky, Jimmy and I are talking with this man. We're talking with him because I think it's important to be fully aware of his subject matter, and that is something that we talk about a lot on this show in terms of political issues, and that is really try not to go with your passion. When you're investing, don't use your heart or gut, as Gleb calls it. You have to have factual information on your hands to eliminate disaster. Now, does this example, when you talk about people going with their gut, as happened with GE recently and Boeing, is this pretty prevalent also in the IT industry, Gleb?
Oh, it happens all the time in the IT industry. I mean, let's look at the very big recent example of WeWork, the darling of the Silicon Valley until just a couple of months ago. Now, that company was valued at something like $47 billion in the last venture investments, and after that, it was actually valued at somewhere between $60 to $90 billion until there was they tried to do an IPO, as many recent technology companies have done, and an investigation into its actual structure and finances revealed a lot of big problems with its governance structure, with its business model, in such a way that its valuation dropped from about $60 to $90 billion, so an average of $75 billion, to, and the latest round of capitalization, $8 billion. Now think about that. From $75 billion to $8 billion, that's over $65 billion of value wiped out. I mean, that's from my perspective, it's hard to imagine $65 billion of a tech company wiped out because of incredible arrogance about the governance structure and about the business model. They were way too confident, and overconfidence bias is one of the biggest problems for the Silicon Valley. People tend to be way too confident about their abilities to change the world. I mean, look at Facebook, for example. Facebook's motto has always been, you know, go fast and break things. Well, they've broken a lot of things. I mean, look at the 2016 election when they let the Russians and other mainly Russian foreign government interfere with the election in such a way that it really screwed up a lot of people and really have changed the dynamics of the political system. And of course, they are also permitting some similar things to happen in the 2020 election. So go fast and break things. It really breaks a lot of things that you don't want broken. So those are two examples of a great deal of overconfidence that has really hurt the valuation of WeWork and our political system as a whole with Facebook.
You know, it seems interesting to me, the overconfidence is the people that go out and market and try to capitalize these companies and want the big IPOs, and they're salespeople. That clearly they're salespeople. Mm-hmm. They're providing a product, but the product is not a tangible product. It's not manufacturing. It's a thought. It's an idea. It's actually a transfer of someone else's efforts, or potentially ether, just electrons. And I wonder sometimes if the entire system, because of our movement towards this type of, you know, this overconfidence and this dependence upon tech, whether maybe we have the most capitalized, you know, businesses on the planet today, Microsoft, Apple, they're technology-based firms. Are we putting too much investment and risk in this in the future, or should we be thinking about other more, you know, specific manufacturing, other tangible outcomes here? Or what do you think about that?
I think that's a very important insight, Jim. And once we think about this, look at the risk profile to our country. The biggest risk right now, from what many forward-looking security experts are telling us, is cybersecurity risk, where we are getting more and more dependent on technology, and that results in foreign adversaries and terrorists and anyone else who has expertise in cybersecurity being able to disrupt our technology-based lifestyle more and more. And think about, you know, you have a smart home, and if somebody has a smart home, what happens if smart homes across the country are hacked and they say, you know, lock your door and you can't get the door open to your home? You know, just one scenario to very many disruptors. Much more important, let's say, is a disruptor of our electric system. which is also dependent on, increasingly dependent on technology, and is a big threat, is a big risk. So I think there's a very high risk that we're taking on right now, which people aren't thinking about. And again, this is going back to the normalcy bias. The normalcy bias where just because something bad hasn't happened in the past, we have very much trouble imagining the negative consequences of this. Just like we couldn't imagine the consequence of planes flying into the Twin Towers, which, you know, I was there in New York when that happened. We can't imagine the consequence of a major cyber terrorist attack or foreign country like Russia or China attack on the U.S. and the kind of hundreds of thousands of lives that might be lost because of it.
And it's not just business decisions, but it's also personal decisions, how much time we spend and how much of our life is actually dependent upon these networks. And the stronger we want to build them, the actual more risk you build into them in one respect, because if you take one piece out of it, it may collapse the rest of the house of cards. That always worries me. With your thoughts, so, you know, if you put these biases out and it comes down to our decisions about our future and the impact on politics in our community, many people are making emotional decisions based on anger and frustration and dissatisfaction that's being perpetuated by a lot of, like, media hype. How much of an impact does that have on our decision-making process for the rest of our lives, you know, in our businesses?
We're down to 2 minutes, yeah, you guys.
We'll quickly say that it has a terrible impact on us because right now the information provided by a lot of social media, which is more and more people, I think the last survey saw that about 67% of people in the United States are getting their information, a lot of their news, significant amount of their news from social media. And the news that they're getting from social media is greatly unfiltered, unfortunately. Yes. You know, the recent news that Facebook is allowing politicians to run fake ads without a problem. And that's a big, big issue. Fake news, according to extensive research, spreads much faster and wider than real news because it's emotionally appealing and people share it. People share what's emotionally appealing, what feels comfortable to them.
So, and of course, companies reaction, make money by clicking on it too, right? But go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Of course. No problem. So because of our ancient gut reactions of wanting to share what makes us angry, frustrated, scared, and so on, these politicians and these political forces are gaining a great deal of power and manipulating the country in very harmful ways for our political system and our future.
No question about that. No question about that. Ladies and gentlemen, we got to cut it here. I'm going to say this. I'm going to put a picture of Gleb's new book on the website adjacent to this interview. All you have to do is click on that and you can pick it up from Amazon. Gleb Cvarsky, thank you so much, sir.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back to KER Politics. It's really not called KER Politics anymore, and I'm going to be saying that probably for the next few weeks. Now we're calling it KER Politics and Investments. Have Rick Rule on the right line with me right now. Rick has graciously agreed to be on the show on a weekly basis whenever he is available. So we're going to be talking theoretically about gold, we're going to be talking about companies, and we're going to be talking about the correct way to invest so you can minimize any losses that may occur. Rick, I really kind of want to start talking here about my perception of gold, because there was a time when I was the biggest gold bug in history. Not as successful as you back in those days, probably not as big as you, but I want to say this, that I had some very, very strong thoughts about the impact that various external factors had on the price of gold. I would like to, at least recently, I'd like to voice my opinions to you, and then if you could give me perhaps some insight into why it didn't work at the time. The first thing that I thought was really important was political issues. I guess I would have to call that international issues. I always felt that when international issues got to a point where people really got concerned about what was going on, that they would hedge their bets by purchasing gold, because gold is accepted among society as the asset of last resort. Well, things are pretty scary right now. I want to talk about one of those and then another one. I want to talk first about the Middle East, and then I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with China and even possibly Russia. But in terms of the Middle East, it is a huge powder keg. There are a myriad of events occurring over there that I think could develop into a very, very serious situation, serious and dramatic situation between the free world and parts of the Middle East. And I'm talking right now, obviously, about potential actions of Iran. We don't know what's going to happen there, but I can guarantee that something will. Why isn't the Iranian situation impacting the price of gold more than it appears to be right now?
I think a study of the gold price going back 40 years suggests that the most important factor with regards to the gold price is people's expectation of the real purchasing power of their savings. Certainly people use other events that they're fearful about as an excuse to buy or sell gold. But a review of the price action on the material, and particularly a review of the price action on the material country by country, suggests that domestic savers are concerned about the ongoing purchasing power in their own currencies. They are, on a global basis, particularly concerned about the ongoing purchasing power of the world's reserve currency, which is the U.S. dollar. So during points in time when the United States is perceived as having a negative real interest rate, money flows out of treasury securities and into gold. My own, and I'm not either a historian or an economist, but my own leads me to believe that many of the things that people suggest are important to the gold price, in particular domestic and international politics, are much less important. There can be localized buying of gold as a consequence of people feeling that they may have to flee their host environment, and knowing that there's no way to get wealth out because their currencies are blocked, they need gold. But in terms of global financial flows, I believe once again that the primary determinant is belief or lack of belief in the purchasing power of fiat currencies.
We have a situation coming up right now, and I'm going to have to lean a little bit on a book I'm reading. But I want to say that in my book club, we're reading, thanks to Al Cornyn's advice, a book about the real dangers of mainland China. Now, most people feel that perhaps mainland China is really not a problem because the federal government, through Donald Trump and everybody else, assures everybody that it's not a problem. But this particular book stresses the fact that it actually could very well be a major problem. And my thought about that is, having had a fair amount of experience with the Chinese people as a director of a bank where I was the only Caucasian, really in any position of, I'll use the word loosely here, authority, it was, I understand the Chinese mentality. Also, my parents grew up in China, and I understand the Chinese mentality probably, I understand it probably better than anybody else. The name of the book, for what it's worth, and you can buy this book, and I have not interviewed the author, but I have to say, I think it's a fascinating book. It's entitled "Deceiving the Sky," and the author really points out the fact that China has not been considered to be a possible enemy to be dealt with. Now, I don't want your opinions on that. I do, but I know what the policy I have to believe probably is that you don't want to talk politics. But the fact of the matter is, China could be a huge, huge bull in the China shop of international affairs in the relatively near future. And the author of this book maintains that it very definitely is. So I guess what I'm saying in this roundabout blather, and it's not blather, and what I'm trying to say here is that if in fact China does become a major problem in international affairs, do you think that could be an ignition of a huge bull market in gold?
I do not.
Okay.
I believe that China will be a huge factor in the gold price because I believe that China's internal economic policies are unsustainable. And I believe that Chinese people will continue to abandon the yuan in favor of gold, but for the reasons that we talked about earlier, because the interest rates paid on savings deposits in yuan are not sufficient to compensate people for the risk that they run in holding yuan. So I believe that China will be important in terms of the gold price, but I suspect not as a consequence of geopolitical reasons.
Simply because of the interest rates that savers in China can look for right now just aren't high enough to make it worth the risk of actually putting their capital into a savings function like that. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. I mean, the Chinese diaspora in particular, but Chinese citizenry more and more, are world famous for savings, for productivity, for education.
You bet.
The savings rate, the domestic savings rate in China is fantastic. And as the Chinese citizenry learn more about the unsustainability of domestic internal economic problems, the endemic corruption, the opacity of their banking sector, more and more individual Chinese are turning to gold as a savings instrument. And the central government in China, ironically, is maybe not ironically, but they're liberalizing gold ownership and in fact are allowing people more and more access to savings products in the form of gold. So I think that China will be an important part in the gold market going forward.
Rick,
but I don't think
Rick, I gotta cut you. Gotta cut you off just for a second.
Yep.
Take a real quick commercial break. Gonna be right back with Rick Rule. Stick around. Welcome back. Continuing our discussion with Rick Rule, I want to say one thing. We're going to talk a little bit more about the impact of China on gold investment. I think I had to cut Rick off a little bit in the last segment for a commercial break. Rick, you want to continue talking about what you were expounding on?
Well, simply that the Chinese people are great savers, and increasingly their government is allowing them to save in gold. And those same people are beginning to understand that some of the domestic policies in China are unsustainable in terms of the opacity of the banking system, as an example. So we expect that the Chinese citizenry will be important consumers of gold. The other thing is that a lot of countries around the world are beginning to object to the territorial overreach of the United States, that is, the United States trying to project its own beliefs and values to countries outside of the borders of the United States.
Listen, I got to tell you, I am so glad that you said that, because I believe that is, I mean, I've known Ron Paul for a long time. When Ron came out, when he was making a run for perhaps the first Libertarian president, although he was trying to run as a Republican, I think that his comment about the reach and the authority that the United States is trying to make on foreign countries is absolutely insane. I agree with that 100%. Sure.
Well, the consequence of that is that a lot of countries want to settle trade between themselves in some mechanism outside the U.S. dollar, given that none of them trust each other's currency. That is to say, the Chinese don't trust the Russians don't trust the Chinese, neither of them trust the Iranians, as an example. All of the central banks would appear to be buying gold as a way to settle transactions between them in some currency outside the U.S. dollar, but one that they have mutual trust in.
Why do you think that action has taken place, Rick?
Well, I think the fact that the United States has, in effect, taken control of the international banking system, the mm-hmm. SWIFT system, and the United States can punish at its own will countries who believe differently than the U.S. administration does, leaves those countries practically no other choice. I can certainly understand it. Well, traditional American values, I'm not talking about current American values, but while traditional American values are the ones that make the most sense to me, I also understand that in terms of decisions made by sovereign nations, my preferences are my business, nobody else's. And they, meaning countries that feel like they've been subjected to capricious American power, it would make absolute sense for them to try and settle in some currency other than the U.S. dollar.
Well, I got to tell you, Rick, if I had a book, you'd be talking it right now. That's exactly how I feel. But we're going to stick to finance here in this particular section. We seem to have an interesting upward rise continuing in the price of gold, and moderately, I would have to say, in the price of silver. How is Sprott planning to take advantage of that, Rick, over the next, let's say, 3 to 5 years?
Well, we certainly encourage people to own physical gold because we agree with the sentiment that the U.S. dollar, at least as expressed by the U.S. 10-year Treasury, the interest rates paid on U.S. dollars don't compensate you for the loss of value in the currency. So we believe in owning gold. Traditionally, the silver price has moved later than the gold price and has moved further. So speculators should own silver, not as an insurance policy, but rather because traditionally that metal has moved further than gold, although it has moved farther and later. The true speculator, the one who cares about the equities in precious metals, needs to begin to emphasize the very high quality silver names. Silver moves further, but silver is fairly abundant. High quality silver stocks are extremely rare. My friend Doug Casey once talked about, in a bull market, the amount of money that wanted to move into silver stocks relative to the availability of those stocks as being analogous to trying to siphon Hoover Dam through a garden hose.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting point that Doug made there. Regardless of that, let's talk a little bit about the equities, because the only place where I had, I've never made a nickel in real estate, although I have had some security, but I have done really quite well in speculative stocks. We talked about this last week because I bet on people. I don't bet necessarily on companies because I don't have the acumen to do that effectively. In the area of silver stocks, without giving any names, what's your philosophy on that, and what's your philosophy on how your very important clients can be serviced in that area, Rick?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand the question.
I was waiting for you to say that. What advice are you giving? Have another beer over here. What advice are your brokers giving to your clients in terms of how to take advantage of the upcoming, what you believe and I believe, will be a bull market in the price of gold?
Got it. Right now, my belief is that you should stick to the best of the best gold stocks, and particularly silver stocks. In my experience, when you come into a gold bull market and later a silver bull market, the move to the upside is so incredible that you don't need to generate alpha. That is, you don't need to outperform the market. You just need to perform in line with the market. Historically, up markets have featured between 200% and 1,200% moves. Rather than trying to outperform a 1,200% move, capture the move, but capture the move with as little risk as you possibly can. So begin a gold and silver stock portfolio with very high quality stocks. After you have invested to capture the market move, then you can begin to speculate to capture alpha.
Now, I have to believe that when you say to capture only high quality stocks in that area, define a high quality stock if you would.
Well, to begin with, I think you want to buy the companies that have the best operating margins, the best balance sheet, and the best built-in growth. Don't confuse these with investment recommendations, but I would suggest the large royalty and streaming companies as an example. The lowest cost gold and silver producers, particularly the lowest cost producers, where they have some measure of revenue growth built in. Everybody wants to own the 10-cent stock that they think is going to go to $1.50. Unfortunately, statistically, most 10-cent stocks go to 5 cents instead.
Generally.
And if you think, as I think, that we are approaching a pretty good market in gold and silver, the most important thing is to capture the beta in the market, with the beta meaning perform alongside the market with as little risk as you possibly can. I'm not saying don't speculate. What I'm saying is invest before you speculate. Have, say, 75% of your money in the best gold, and in particular in the best silver equities.
You know, I think that's really good advice. That's something that I try to keep in mind during the 40 years or so that I was involved in the market. I think that's really, really good advice. It's analogous, in my opinion, to the advice of a lot of folks who are selling physical gold, and that is only put a portion of your assets, and I think the number for gold is around maybe at the very highest 20% of your assets into the physical gold itself. That's pretty much what you're saying, only you're saying put 75, if you're in the securities area, put 75% in high quality securities, and then play with the 25%. Rick, we're down to about 30 seconds here. Say anything you want to end this up.
Well, I'd like to repeat a prior offer that I would be delighted to rank portfolios from your subscribers. If your subscribers want to send me their natural resources portfolios, names and symbols in text to rankings, RANKINGS, at sproutglobal.com, I will rank the portfolios and comment on the companies and send them back by return email. Absolutely no obligations.
And absolutely in total confidence. Rick Roll, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Remember, that's rankings, RANKINGS, at sproutglobal.com.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.